on this episode of Adventures in Being Gifted.
But I was surprised, maybe I shouldn't be, and again, working with teenagers for so long, that the overarching concerns are universal and they're not dependent on time. And that acceptance, that, you know, fear of not being good enough, the what do I become when I'm not a kid anymore? All of those things are really been cemented, I think, in the kids' minds, no matter what year we do the survey or what year we work with the kids.
That and a whole lot more coming up. Before we dive in, we wanted to give you a heads up about some of the audio in this episode. Sometimes we love technology and sometimes we don't. This was one of the times we didn't love it. Throughout the interview, you may hear a little digital echo occurring from a phone connection. We tried to eliminate it, but it just wouldn't go away. It's a bummer and we apologize, but what you're about to listen to is worth every second, regardless of some annoying audio issues. Thanks for listening to Adventures in Being Gifted. Hello, everyone. Today we are talking about gifted teens with two of the most esteemed experts in gifted education, Judy Galbraith and Dr. Jim Delisle. What does a gifted teenager think about being gifted? What does being gifted really mean? How do gifted teens handle stress? And how might gifted teens deal with perfectionism? Over the past 40 years, their book, The Gifted Teen Survival Guide, has literally served as an owner's manual for teens who have been identified as gifted and talented, and how to inform, understand, and address these typical questions from gifted teens. Parents and teachers have also used this book to better understand life as a gifted teen and how to parent a gifted adolescent. Jim and Judy recently published the fifth edition, which includes several updates about mindfulness, new information on 2E or twice exceptionalities and neurodiversity, autism spectrum or disorder, mental health, LGBTQ+, and career and college options for teens after high school.
So what's the best way to find out about gifted teens today, post-pandemic? Ask teens themselves. Judy and Jim conducted an online survey of 1,400 gifted teens to help provide a relevant and meaningful understanding of the most important topics to teens today. Their book provides a comprehensive and well-rounded perspective of the science behind gifted teens and the important aspects of a teenager: social, emotional, academic, relationships with teachers, friends, mental wellness, career options, and proactive approaches to these areas in a teen's life. Judy and Jim have included real-life stories from the students surveyed throughout the book, allowing readers to know they aren't alone in feeling how they feel or think the way they think.
A little background on our guests. Judy Galbraith has a master's degree in guidance and counseling of the gifted. She is the former president and founder of Free Spirit Publishing, which is now an imprint of teacher-created materials. Some of her additional well-known books are The Gifted Kids Survival Guide, which we use with our third graders, When Gifted Kids Don't Have All the Answers, which she co-wrote with Jim Delisle, What Kids Need to Succeed, and What Teens Need to Succeed. These are just a few of her many books. Judy is officially retired, but has spent decades devoting her career to counseling, teaching, and supporting gifted kids, their parents, and educators.
With 42 years in education, Jim Delisle, PhD, is a retired professor of education at Kent State, here in Ohio. He worked with gifted students from grades 2nd to 10th. Even in his retirement, he still has the mission to make gifted education as important to people as special education, and hopes that education can be recognized as the right for all gifted kids to have an education that matches their abilities. He is also the author of many well-known books in our gifted world, such as his most recent book, Doing Poorly on Purpose.
Well, we are so happy to welcome both of you to our podcast conversation.
We are happy to be here. It's always a blast, and always fun to talk about gifted kids.
I feel the same way.
Well, congratulations to the two of you. Having the fifth edition of the Gifted Teen Survival Guide is quite an accomplishment. This book is all things gifted, all topics relating to being a gifted teenager. We love how it covers a gifted 101 type feel at the beginning with the definitions of giftedness and the groundwork that you laid for our students, or I should say our teens, in helping them really understand what it means to be gifted and all the nuances of being gifted. You also include how the brain works at this stage in life, which is important for teens themselves, along with their parents and educators that work with them. The myths associated with being gifted, providing more of an understanding for their emotions and big emotions, intense emotions, just all the things that you could cover, you covered in this book. So we are really quite thankful that you've written basically an owner's manual for gifted teens. Where did you guys get your passion for teens?
Well, I'll go first. Even when I was a teenager and I had jobs, I loved working with teens and preteens. I was a park attendant. I was a swimming instructor at the Y. I was a waterfront director at a Y. And I always just had an affinity toward that age group. And sometimes people would say, are you nuts? Do you like working with teenagers? And I'm like, yeah. I just love their energy, their curiosity. And that's just an age group that I've always been drawn to. Toddlers, I like to tell people, make me nervous. They're always darting about, banging into things, falling. And I always have like mini panic attacks when I'm around them because I'm just afraid for them to have some like fatal accident. And so that, you know, that's just, and even as a teacher, I always preferred working with middle school or even high school students.
Yeah. With me, I never thought I'd work with teenagers. My background is special ed for working with kids with disabilities. And I thought my first teaching job was working with kids from grades 1 through 6. And basically, I thought that's where I was going to stay. And then I met one of my sixth graders who was labeled as a kid with behavior disorders, emotional issues, and all those things. And he was in my classroom for about 4 hours a day. And as I like to say, he hated me like the devil hates holy water. But there were a series of different events that I came about out of desperation. I changed his curriculum to make it more appealing to his interests. And I saw a turnaround in this kid that just took me aback. And I'd never really looked at education from the other side of the desk, from the kid's side of the desk. And so here was this one kid who turned out to be incredibly bright, but I didn't know it. I couldn't see through all of the disguises that he put up and all the guards that he put up. And so I started thinking that might be a place I'd like to work with older kids, as well as what got me into gifted, because I didn't know you could have a behavior problem and also be a gifted kid. Now I thought it was one label or the other. And so that really got me into it. And then I started working, even though I was a professor, I found that job too easy. So I started working with 7th and 8th grade gifted kids when I was teaching in Ohio, and never looked back. I've been doing that now. That started 1990, 1991. And even though I retired from high school teaching 2 years ago, that has been the best time of my career, is working with kids who are just a little bit older than I thought I'd ever work with.
So it sounds like you both had just those personal connections and those personal relationships to really, you know, enhance that passion that you have for teens.
That's it.
Yep.
So when we say teens, what kind of age group? Are you talking, you know, middle school, high school? Are you talking like 13 to 18 kind of age range?
Well, for me, it's middle school and high school. You always will encounter a fourth grader who's going on their senior year of high school. But yeah. Typically, I consider it middle school and high school students.
It's interesting that adolescence is a 20th century invention, because, you know, earlier than that, kids went directly from being kids to going to work in the factories. And only when we changed those laws in the late 1800s, early 1900s, did we realize there was this period that wasn't quite kid, wasn't adult, and we had to do something with it. And that's what adolescence is. So I've always carried that with me, that adolescence to me can start as young as 11 years old, just kind of as Judy said, if you're really bright, you know, maybe in a lower grade, but some of the other elements of adolescence creep in. And given the economics of life today and recently, adolescents could actually continue into the 20s, into the early 20s. If you're still living at home, if you're still economically dependent, some of the same issues that you would confront as a teenager, you kind of still have in a maybe slightly different way as a 20-something. So adolescence didn't exist 100 years ago or so, and now it's one of the longest periods of anyone's life.
That's a great point. Way to bring the history into the understanding of it all. So tell us a little bit about your favorite things that you find in Gifted Kids.
Well, I'll go first. I love their curiosity, and I love their passion for learning. I mean, I always was frustrated as a teacher because I felt like no matter what I did, they were through the material and half the time that any other student was through it. And that no matter what challenges I threw their way, they embraced them. And but I also like the fact that they weren't afraid to ask, at least they weren't afraid with me, because I felt like I had a gifted, friendly classroom. And that's something Jim and I talk about in our book, but they weren't afraid to ask provocative questions. And my all-time favorite was when I was a fairly new teacher in a middle school, and I had six really smart kids in my class. At that time, there was no gifted education program, but they would ask questions like, "Ms. Galbraith, why are we doing this?" And and I think, oh my gosh, I'm not sure I know why I'm doing anything at this point, you know, in my early education career. But it really got me thinking. And then when I first started surveying gifted kids, then my surveys were on paper. There was no such thing as, you know, e-surveys. And students would write in the margins and they'd say, you know, I think this question is rather ambiguous. I think instead you should ask this. And they actually helped me improve my surveys over the years by finessing the language and the level of depth of the questions and so on. So I was never threatened by a young person who asked those kinds of questions. I think some educators, unfortunately, are. And instead of using that as a quote unquote teachable moment, they may feel upset about that. But I always took it as a great learning opportunity. And when you show students respect for those kinds of questions, they feel cared about and they feel safe in your classroom. And so it's a very important dynamic to develop and encourage, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, actually everything Judy said is I would definitely second them, because what I have found is that oftentimes gifted kids have a filter that they can tell truth from garbage pretty quickly, and they don't give teachers, maybe adults in general, they don't give them a whole lot of time before they make a judgment about whether they're worth listening to. That's one thing I think I've appreciated the most about gifted kids is their brutal honesty. Not in every situation, because if they're in a situation where a teacher is, as Judy said, intimidated by their intelligence, they're just going to kind of lay back or act out, one or the other. But if they find in you someone who they feel they can identify with, they can communicate with in an open way, I think then you found a friend for life, so to speak, with gifted kids. And one thing I found in our book, and to me, I think the highlight in the book, the 21 essays written by gifted teenagers and a couple of gifted adults, they talk about everything from perfectionism to suicide to not fitting in because of their race or gender or sexual orientation. They talk so honestly, and the names are on it. This is not anonymous. These kids, these teenagers are just wanting to help others by basically sharing your own lives. And that's what I found, is that if you're really lucky, you get to have these kids see you as someone who is a compatriot with them, and they share their compassion and their passions with you.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with that. We definitely do that here in our classroom. We always allow our students to have a say in like what we're learning, what we're doing, how they're doing it, how they're going to show their learning. You know, they have such ownership in that way. And we truly see them soar because of that. And they know, you know, their opinion matters.
Well, and I think you recognize that, I'm sure, Jill and Jessica, you found this, is that even though you may have taught the kids when they were 10, 11 years old, they come back to see you. They want to go back to see who you are, what you've done, how you've grown, how you've stayed the same. And that doesn't happen a lot with between teachers and kids. You know, occasionally you'd have that in a regular setting. But I found that with gifted kids, oftentimes they come back years later, in some cases many years later, just because they want to connect with you again.
I've found that to be true, too. Sometimes even 10 or 20 years later, I'll get a letter out of the blue from a young person that I taught, and they feel motivated, held, whatever, to let me know how much it meant for them to be in my classroom. And that's something that I'd like to communicate to the teachers listening to the podcast or the people that you work with, is don't underestimate the influence and the positive support that you impart on your people, because even though they may not show it at the time, you are having a serious impact.
Yeah, I just had lunch in New York City with one of my former seventh grade students, who's now 36 years old, the father of a 6 year old, and he picked up the bill, which was even better.
You know? But that's amazing.
Yeah, but I mean, they don't hang around like that unless you've impacted them in more than just an academic way.
Yeah. All right. So going back to your book and thinking about this survival guide, do you recommend that teens read this book with their parent, or could they use it in a classroom? So what do you think is the best approach for, you know, teens receiving this information?
I don't think there's any one best approach. I mean, I think it's important for parents to read this book because it will give them a lot of insight into what their young person is feeling and experiencing that they may have no clue about. And in an ideal world, yeah, a teenager and his or her parents would go through the book together and have conversations about it. But I've also heard from parents that they found our book under their child's pillow. So they were reading it at night, kind of in secret. And, you know, that's kind of cool, too. And whatever way they feel most comfortable is what I would say. I've had some parents say, oh, my child would never read this book. And I'm like, you know, you might be really surprised. Just leave it out on the coffee table and see what happens. And invariably, the book disappears. And the kids resonate with just the title alone. And then they can't help but open up the book anywhere and find something of interest, of relevance, that gets them thinking. And the book I know, and Jim, you can comment on this too, is used as a book sort of study guide in many GT classes, because I've gotten literally hundreds and hundreds of letters from young people who were going through the book as a part of their class, and they were invited to write to me as the author. And I've always cherished those letters. They were always interesting, and kids always had questions for me, like, are you gifted? And Jim, I don't know if you're going to attest to that, but I think I've been asked, are you gifted more than the planet?
Yeah, lots of times, yeah. Well, kids want that affiliation. They want, you know, what I always say is you don't outgrow giftedness. You know, it's not something that's school-based, it's you-based. Yeah. And they need, I think they're looking for that, not just connection, but that feeling of lack of isolation, I guess, that, yeah, I can grow up to be somebody else, like an adult who's got some of the same characteristics that I have and not have to be ashamed of the label. What I found is that with in our book, later in the book, we talk about how kids and parents have different relationships when it comes to how comfortable they are speaking with each other. I mean, sometimes it would be, as Judy said, very difficult for kids and parents to get together and have a conversation about some of the topics in the book. And for others who are pretty freeloading, I mean, free talking with each other, they could open up conversations by having you both read the same chapter and then, you know, make comparisons about what stood out to you. As a teacher, I use the book. It's funny because one of the kids I taught was like, "Mr. D, do you realize the guy that wrote this book has the same name that you have?" I thought it was funny. But what I do is I will assign a chapter, and then I'll just say to the kid, what I'd like you to do each is just come up with up to three points that seem most relevant to you. And then when we go back the next week to talk about that assignment, if you will, it really is led by them. This, you know, they have questions about it, or they have comments about it, or they say, well, this didn't really fit me, but this one did. And I think that's a good way to use it. But as Judy said, just leaving it out on the coffee table, not saying a whole lot about it, that can work too.
Yeah, it makes me think what you were talking about when the students realize that you too are a grown-up gifted kid, that our teacher down the hall, she has openly started sharing with the students that she has ADD, and they, like, you wouldn't believe the connections that they make, and they can openly talk about it. And then those students who are either in the process of being diagnosed, because that kind of happens a lot in third grade, or have already been diagnosed, they just make that immediate connection. So it's a real thing. I mean, kids love to know, like, oh, you're grown up and you're having that same struggle or that same, you know, thing going through like I do, that same issue.
I had this happen the last year I was teaching. I worked in a high school that was a high school for gifted kids, a very small private public high school in South Carolina. And one of the chapters included an essay by a young person who at the time had a label of Asperger's, which now they don't use the term anymore. It's more autism spectrum. But nonetheless, this kid, who is now a freshman in high school, didn't know that there were other people like him. He read this essay. He brought the book home to his mom and he said, "This is who I am." She'd never discussed it with him. And he just felt this revelation. I was at the beach about a month ago where I taught, and we have lunch now, even though it's 2 years since I retired. And he just wants to talk because he found some affiliation with an essay, you know, written by somebody who he said, "This guy sounds like me." And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's those connections, really. You just can't ever, you know, underestimate the power of that. So we know that you conducted a pretty large survey to help you write this fifth edition of the book, and you were able to survey 1,400 teens. And we're just super curious, what were some of the biggest new topics or new concerns that gifted teens are struggling with in the current day? I know this was printed before 2023, but I think it kind of carries over. So what are the biggest things that you found since your fourth edition?
I have to be honest that we did not conduct all new surveys for the fifth edition, but I've been surveying gifted kids continuously for probably 30 years. And in the most recent round of surveys, the surprise for me was how pragmatic responses were in terms of the help they wanted or the additional information that readers wanted. So, for example, teenagers wanted help with time management and how to prioritize, which that is so pragmatic. It really surprised me. I mean, and you know, also they were asking for things that don't cost a nickel. They were asking for things like, we'd like teachers to be more flexible in grading, flexible about assignment, you know, which all that requires is a mindset of greater flexibility and greater differentiation. And so kids weren't asking for anything expensive or pie in the sky. And so I thought that was really, really interesting. And one of the things that I also noted was, while there were some issues that continue to be problematic or a challenge for these students, like perfectionism and expectations of them that are sometimes inhumane or that at the very least unrealistic, there were also a greater percentage of students who said that they were not as likely to dumb down who they were or what they do. And I was glad to see that lever move in a positive direction. And the overarching response was, if I have to dumb down in order to fit in, then it's not worth it. I want to be myself.
Yeah, that's great insight.
Yeah, and I think what I found, and it's probably not surprising, is some of the foundational characteristics are the same, whether it was edition one or edition five. These kids, they still want to be liked. They still want to be accepted for who they are. They still want an education that's worthwhile. I think, as Judy said, they are more open about expressing themselves to, especially for educational purposes, for trying to get something that is more meaningful than the usual stuff that they were getting. But I was surprised, maybe I shouldn't be, and again, working with teenagers for so long, that the overarching concerns are universal and they're not dependent on time, and that acceptance, that, you know, fear of not being good enough, the what do I become when I'm not a kid anymore, all of those things are really been cemented, I think, in the kids' minds, no matter what year we do the survey or what year we work with the kids. I do think, and we may get into this later, that one huge difference is the impact of social media on these kids' lives, both in a positive, but oftentimes in a negative way, especially for young girls, young teenage girls. But that probably is something that is bigger than, you know, our book. It's more systemic to our whole society.
Yeah.
I agree completely.
Yeah. So talk to us more about some of these big issues with gifted teens, like rising levels of stress, anxiety, suicide ideation. So there are difficult issues definitely to bring up and have authentic conversations with about our teens. So do you have any advice on how to start a conversation about these topics for parents, or vice versa? How do you advise parents on bringing up these topics with their teens?
I think first of all, yeah, these topics have risen in importance over the past few years, much more so than I'm happy with. In terms of the levels of stress and anxiety, it really does go back to, I think, societal and parental expectations that these kids have, and self-expectations that they feel they are either the best or they're nothing. Just one example from the school in which I taught until recently. Again, this is a school for all gifted kids, but when they come in as ninth graders, this might be the first time in their entire school history where they are not the smartest kid in class. And so that creates a new dynamic that's very uncomfortable for a lot of these kids. I've had some kids say, I'd rather get a D than a B plus, because at least when I get a D, everyone agrees I could have done better. But if I get a B plus and that's the best I could do, I still feel like a failure. So in a sense, psychologically speaking, a D is safer than a B plus to a lot of these kids. And that's a sad place that we've been. So I think instead of, you know, I'm openly talking right away about suicide and all that, I think we really need to start talking about expectations and then see where it goes, see how the kids are reacting, see how the teens are reacting as you're bringing up topics about that. You know, I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to be as successful as you are. Those are some of the things that you'd hear that you, as a parent, want to take seriously. One thing we should not do as parents, and we're so prone to do this, and even as teachers, is to say something, you know, you're so smart, you'll make it, don't worry about it. Or you've got everything going for you with the brain that you have. That is so demeaning to kids, because all it does is put them in a place where they even feel less worthwhile than they did before you raised that question. And one thing, I have studied the suicide quite a bit among gifted youth. And one thing I like to say to parents is, if you are afraid as an adult that your child is either suicidal or looking at some type of self-harm, don't keep that information to yourself. You cannot overreact. I've had suicidal teens where when I mentioned, I said, you know, some people who feel the way you do often think of taking their lives. Has that ever crossed your mind? And people say, you can't say that to the kid. Trust me, if you said it and they're thinking it, you're not going to be the one who's putting that idea in their head. So I think, you know, we need to bring in psychologists when things get serious. We need to bring in school counselors, et cetera. But overall, I don't think we need to be afraid as adults to bring up some of these most sensitive issues just to see where our kids are, just again, kind of gauge their emotions and their well-being.
Thank you for saying that.
I agree with everything Jim said. And I've had parents, after I've done a parent presentation for parents of gifted kids, wait around until almost everybody's gone, and then they'll describe what's going on with their child. And I'll say, well, have you considered getting professional help? Because it sounds like you've been dealing with this and your child has been dealing with this for months and months and months. And, you know, there's help out there for you and your child, and you don't need to continue to suffer wondering what you're doing wrong and how to fix it. Sometimes, you know, that adage, you can't see the forest for the trees, is so true. And I think anytime, I agree with Jim, you're not putting these ideas into kids' heads. All they have to do is turn on a television or watch a news feed on their phone or talk with their peers. And kids who are suffering from depression, you know, suicide ideation or whatever, they need somebody to talk to about it. And keeping it all to themselves only makes the seriousness of the situation worse. So we need to stop stigmatizing mental health issues as being a weakness in humans, but rather part of the human condition at times, and help kids through that, knowing that, so they know they have an ally or allies.
Now, one thing I've done with kids, not those who are really at severe risk at the moment, but just in general, I'll say to the kids, if you're really feeling down, you're just feeling sad, you're just feeling not right, you have to ask yourself to halt. That's H-A-L-T. And they stand for hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. If you are any of those things, take care of them first and then see how you feel. Now, the hardest one is lonely. You can't do that by eating a sandwich. You can't get rid of that by that. But at the same time, by putting something into the kid's head of what they can ask themselves, if things just aren't looking or feeling right at a particular time, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, really is kind of the baseline of, if I take care of those basic needs, am I okay or not? So that's something I've shared with kids many, many times. It seems to help.
At what point do you suggest or recommend a teen or a parent going to get professional help for the teen that might be having some of these thoughts or dealing with depression?
When you feel as a parent that you've tried everything and it just hasn't worked, you've talked to people at school, if they're not, you know, if they're homeschooled, it's a different story. But if they're at school, basically saying, I've noticed these changes in my child's behavior. Have you noticed anything at school? Usually if it happens in one place, it happens in another. Like at home, it's also at school. Not always, though. And if your child is or your teen is reluctant to go to see someone professionally, and many times they will be, I think the best way to show them that you support them is to agree to go with them initially. And maybe you even as a parent have to go by yourself first and say, I'm really concerned about my daughter, my son. Do you think it's time for us to get together? The hard part is right now, it's so hard to access mental health services for teenagers. It's really tough. I don't have a solution for that, to be honest. But that's, you know, if you're lucky enough to be able to be in a situation and in a place where you can find that support and afford that support, then that's the time to go. But when you are at wit's end and say, I don't know what to do anymore, that's the time to seek help.
Yeah, I agree completely. It is a sad commentary on our society that there aren't more readily available mental health services for everyone, not just kids and parents, but really for everyone. I'd like to echo that when you've tried everything and nothing seems to be helping, that's definitely the time to reach out and get help.
So, you know, staying on this topic, thinking about, Judy, you mentioned a second ago, we don't necessarily have to hold back talking about it because they're going to see it. It's on the TV, it's on their phones, it's all over social media. So how much of these topics, or how much of has this, you know, these problems been affected by social media? Have you guys seen this increase and change throughout your careers? And even, it makes me think of the pandemic as well.
Yeah, I just read yesterday that this is teenagers and adults. They tend to look at their phones on the average of every 4 minutes. My guess is with teenagers, that's even more frequent than that. I do think I don't think yet we know the full impact of either social media or the pandemic. That's going to be years in the telling, so to speak. It has definitely had an impact. If you want to know something, you don't have to look it up anymore and wait till you get to a library. You have the library, you have the world in front of you. That's really great, but it can also be really debilitating if it's something that's is not appropriate for you to see or to experience. So I don't know. Maybe Judy has a better solution to that, but I don't think we know at this point the full impact either of the pandemic on kids' educations and their lives or the impact of social media in a negative way.
Well, I think the American Society of Pediatrics, forgive me if I don't have that organization right, has done a lot of reports on the importance of parents limiting the amount of screen time children of all ages, especially young children, have. And what's really frustrating to me is when you walk into a restaurant these days, there'll be a couple with two or three kids and everybody's staring at their phone. They're not talking to each other. You know, they might even be texting each other at the restaurant. And how do you know how your child is doing if you're not having conversations with them? I'm sorry, a text isn't particularly revealing or supportive or whatever. And I think that we need to encourage parents to do the hard work of setting limits. And David Walsh has a great book that came out some years ago, Dr. David Walsh. The title is Know, Why You Need to Say It and Why Your Children Hear It. I think that's the exact title, but it's close to that, if not exact. And that really resonated with me because today it seems like adults are reticent to say no to young people. Like, no, this isn't okay. This isn't a value that we support. No, we really don't want you engaged in this. And here's why. And you know, I'm not super restricted, but you know, when everybody's on their phone all the time, like I said earlier, they're not talking to each other. And so it's, I think Jim is exactly right that we won't know for a while what the true effects of COVID and the whole, you know, doing school from home thing and the impacts of media, social media, and all things related will be, but it doesn't seem like the positives outweigh the negatives necessarily.
That's such a great topic we talk about all the time, is just how can we get these teens off their phones periodically? You know, I agree, Judy, that I've seen kids and their families at the restaurants or waiting together or wherever they are, and they're all heads down on their phones. And you're like, oh, how can we break this up? How can we, you know, change that habit?
And not make it the norm. We can't have that be the norm. It's just sad.
Yeah.
I worked at a residential summer camp for gifted kids for about 10 years. And the kids have to give up their phones as soon as they come onto the grounds. And for the first 2 days, there's total withdrawal. The kids have no clue what to do with with their time, with their fingers, or anything. But by day three, I'd say the majority of kids are like, okay, you know, I wish I had my phone for something, but overall, they're pretty comfortable with it. So maybe there needs to be a time when, just as a whole family, because if you tell your kids you can't be on your phone and you're on it yourself as a parent, that's sending a wrong message.
My mom, at Christmas this past year, she made everybody turn in their phones into a little decorated box, and we couldn't be on our phones, and it actually worked. It was great.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah.
What is your most important message that you would like to tell gifted teens?
The message that I've heard from readers over the years, and I'm sure Jim has too, is that our book has helped young people realize they're not alone. That, in fact, there are many, many, many gifted kids and teens and people around the world. And while it might be hard at times for them to deal with school being, less challenging than they would like, or it might be a little harder for them to make close friends, and they may sometimes feel at odds with their peers. In fact, there are lots of us out there who are also gifted, and, they're going to be okay. They're going to be okay.
Well, I have a confession to make, which is, of all the books I've written, I've never read one cover to cover after they've come out,
really?
including this one. So today, in preparation for the podcast, I thought, I'm going to go look through the book again. And know what I was attracted to the most was the essays that I mentioned earlier, the 21 essays written by teenagers and a couple of adults as well. I think that if we have a kid who's reluctant to listen to us as adults, they'll listen to people their own age or just slightly older. And I think that's probably what I got the most from our book after finally reading it, was that the kids have so much advice they can give, everything from, popularity, friendship, careers, choosing any of life's big decisions, or confronting any of life's big issues. I think it's best said in the first person by someone who's experienced it. So as much as I think our book gives really good advice, I would say that the best aspect of it is just having the kids and the teenagers and the adults write about how they've experienced giftedness. So then I can read it and go, oh yeah, that sounds like me, or it doesn't sound like me. So it kind of goes along with what Judy said, but in a slightly different way.
Oh, that is such a great message from both of you. Thank you.
So both of you are definitely household names to those of us who have spent a decade or more in education and or as parents. I know all of my gifted classes, I think at some point, probably assigned a book written by one of you. So what would you want people to take away the most from you and your work with gifted teens?
Mine would be that adults should listen 75% of the time and talk 25% of the time. Kids nobody likes to be lectured or told all these shoulds, you should do this, you should be that. And I find that if I've been successful in working with the teens I have, it's because I don't over-talk. I listen more than I probably should, but I find that those pauses that seem uncomfortable are sometimes the best times to see what's going to happen next if you as an adult don't interfere and add in some of your own two cents. So I would say for adults, I would say listen three times more than you talk, and that will give you a relationship with your gifted teen, or maybe any teen, that is based on who they are rather than who you'd like them to be.
I agree with that completely, and I would add that as a part of that listening, asking questions is really important. And over the years, I've had kids write, no one's ever asked me these questions before about school and peer relationships and life at home. And I think all young people, not just the kids, need an opportunity to talk about life's big issues, because life is complicated. It's often not easy. And no matter who you are, you are going to encounter challenges that are sometimes a real struggle. And if you know somebody cares and is going to listen, per Jim's comment, it can make an enormous difference.
That is some great advice from both of you. Is there anything that you wanted us to ask that we haven't yet asked in this episode?
Well, I'm glad you didn't ask, which parts of the book did Judy write? Which parts did I write? Because honestly, I couldn't tell you. Our writing style, we've written together before. So our writing styles are so similar. Our beliefs, our foundational core is so similar that other than a few portions of the book that I know I wrote or know she wrote, I couldn't tell you where one started and the other ended. So I think that shows the great collaboration. Yeah, it's a great collaboration that we have. Kind of sounds like Jessica and Jill. Good collaboration you have. We have the same kind as writers. We never even got together. I mean, we did this all without meeting each other. You know, we did it sending things back and forth. Yeah. And I think we've done that with virtually every book we've written together. So Obviously we're a good team.
Well, it would be really cool if we could have another episode someday about how to write a book for anyone, like educators or parents that would be interested in writing about their experiences with gifted kids or a gifted topic, if you're ever up for that.
Oh, definitely. And I want to add one question that we didn't talk about is the support that GT teachers and parents of GT students need, because as a GT specialist, you are part of a minority in education. And as a parent of a gifted kid, you're also part of a minority. And just as sometimes kids feel alone and unappreciated or like they speak up, so do parents and so do teachers of the gifted. And I remember when I was first a K-8 GT coordinator, I was in the teacher's lounge and I'm in Minnesota, and somebody asked me, how many eggs loons lay? Now, loons are state birds. And I said, I have absolutely no clue. And she said to me, well, you're that gifted teacher. How come you don't know this? And I thought, man, this is just what the kids deal with. Somebody thinking you should have all the answers just because you're doing this work or you're this particular student. And also, parents of gifted kids don't get a lot of empathy. It's not like you can say to your neighbor, oh, it's so frustrating having a kid who's so smart and is working 2, 3, 4 years above their same age peers. No, you're never going to say that to a neighbor, because I can tell you the reaction you're going to get, and it's not going to be a support. It's not likely a supportive one. Right. And so I think just as young people need support, so do GT teachers and parents. And that's why advocacy groups and organizations that support GT teachers are really critical.
That's a well-intended point. We always say support the support.
All right. Well, we just want to say thank you so much for your time today and all of your insights on this amazing book that you have collaborated on together. And hopefully all of our listeners will go pick it up.
Well, thank you for your interest. And this has been fun. And Jim, it's been great to quote unquote be with you.
I know. It's been a while.
It's like a little reunion.
Yeah, it is.
It is a reunion of sorts. Yeah. Well, again, thanks, Jill. Thanks, Jessica. This has been a joy.
We appreciate you. Keep doing what you are doing for gifted education. We appreciate everything that you've done and continue to do. It's really just a legacy that you have left.
Well, thank you so much.
I'm so excited that we got to talk to both of them. I know we've had Jim on a previous episode, but these two names are huge in our gifted world. And I know I have looked up to them and cherished the words that they have written in their books. So it's such a unique experience to be able to talk to them.
I know. It was such an honor, and they're just delightful. I think what was really neat in their spirit of being willing to talk to us is that they just love these gifted teens, and they really honored and highlighted all the great things about them, and they really want the gifted teens to be heard. And so I think this episode really highlights these issues that, as Jim said it, are universal concerns over time that really truly stay the same, which I was surprised to hear.
Yeah. And I loved Judy's message about not the only one. Mm-hmm. I feel we are so lucky to be GISs and to be able to have this pullout program that we have, because our students truly feel that they are not the only one. Then mm-hmm. when they're with us, they are able to connect with the kids that they're with and the time that they're with us. And I'm not sure they, you know, truly get that outside or in their normal, in their normal classrooms.
And to that point, that is why our district clusters gifted kids, so that in homerooms they are with a small group of gifted students, and then when they come to us in the pullout resource room once a day for about 40 minutes, they still have other kids that they connect with, they relate to, they understand they're not the only ones.
Yeah, and they can talk to each other, because also what Jim said about they often will listen to each other more so than they listen to a parent or mm-hmm. sometimes an educator or a teacher that they are with. But they truly will take the advice from each other mm-hmm. more so than anybody else.
And speaking of talking, wasn't that cool what Jim said about listening 75% of the time and talking 25% of the time? I thought that was really
insightful. I wrote that down and I'm going to try to practice it.
No kidding. And even just the pausing. He mentioned pausing, and that is another crucial strategy that we use as teachers and educators, but it really is powerful. And I don't think we are brave enough to always use it, because it is awkward. It does, is uncomfortable.
Yeah, it does feel.
But it does give people a beat to think about and to really, you know, give them that courage to be honest and let them know, like, we're here. We want to hear you. What do you have to say?
Yeah. And the connections piece, it relates right to that. It is critical. And I think we have literally said this on repeat throughout all of our episodes, but connection with kids is critical. And it makes a huge difference when you're wanting them to learn.
And just having that fluidity, that's really nice about our building, that we have four grade levels, that the students can walk down the hallway and be able to come and visit or see us on a pretty regular basis. We also have done something over the last several years where we have, you know, pulled certain students that have shown some leadership interest and or ability or high skill. And we've been able to pull them once a month right before the school day starts and just group them together. They're, you know, over the span of three grade levels, so they're different ages. So that idea of mentoring and working together as a group to do good and to do some type of a service project for our school or for the leaders of our school or for the grounds of the school, whatever it might be, for the bus drivers. But that, you know, has really lent us to keep a hold of those relationships that we've formed with our former students, and for them to get together and for them to really practice that leadership piece that is a part of the gifted program anywhere. So it's just awesome to hear those affirmations from Judy and Jim, and just to keep sharing this advocacy about gifted kids and gifted education and how important it is to keep the programs in place that bring those kids together, that help them feel seen and feel heard, along with just building up those skills that they need.
Yeah. And so if you are a parent or an educator of a gifted teen, highly recommend going and grabbing the Gifted Teen Survival Guide. And like Judy said, maybe leave it on the coffee table and see what happens.
That's right. And parents, if you have a child younger than the age of 11, this is the time to read this book. Don't wait until they are teenagers. Read it now before they are. And that way you'll be better prepared. I know from our own experience of having teens now, this book is relevant and you want to be prepared. So get it now. Ladies and gentlemen, and teens yourselves, get this book.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of Adventures in Being Gifted. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite place to listen to podcasts to hear our next episode.
Share with your friends, colleagues, and anyone you think would benefit from Adventures in Being Gifted.
And we want to know what you want to hear more about. So let us know by tweeting us at Being Gifted Pod or emailing us at adventuresinbeinggifted@gmail.com.
Until next time.